Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung. Singapore is a laboratory for the city of the 21st century. This place is spectacular, a hypermodern metropolis in a tropical area, a balance of high-tech and nature, a lab for the world, how growth and sustainability go together. There is one important rule in Singapore. All new buildings must give nature back what they have taken from it. Our guest today is Rudi Scheuermann, global leader of the building envelope team at Arup in Berlin. And Rudi, we personally first met in Singapore 2 years ago, I guess. Remember the Jung architecture talks back then, live on stage?
Yes, sure. It was great.
So, and I think Richard Hassel from the VOHA office was with you on stage, and we were talking about green buildings and high-rises, green high-rises. So what was your experience in Singapore concerning green high-rises?
Well, first of all, I have to say, Singapore is a particular good place to think about green high-rises. And VOHA and Richard Hassel with his partner are contributing to that really, really well. And I have to say, I fell in love with their projects because they exactly do what I'm trying to promote we should do, which is sort of the rule in Singapore that you give back to nature what you actually take.
So my colleague Katerina is joining us in today's episode.
Nice to have you with us today, Rudi. Should we, or even the world, take Singapore as an example?
We should take it as an example, but we have to be also fair that the conditions that we find in Singapore are very advantageous for green building envelope, and we don't have the same easy qualities everywhere else in the world. In some places we do, but in a lot of places we don't, and then we have to work a little bit harder to give back what we occupy by building a building on that plot.
The idea was to like to work with plants. They usually grow in the countries where the projects are, no? Because the mistake is usually that they're using plants from other regions and try to involve them as they're maybe a little bit more beautiful, or...
Which makes it also difficult to survive for the plants.
Yes. I mean, that's sort of a general problem that very often designers want to design. And the profit isn't much worth in its own country. So, you know, home plants are very often not being considered to be sort of extraordinary enough. If you make such a gesture, then people often try to be very, very extraordinary. And that is sometimes sort of the mistake to trip over. What you should do is you should allow to use plants which actually naturally grow in these places. And I often give this example: after reunification in Germany, there was a time when it wasn't clear who owned buildings in East Germany, because there was a sort of a reclaim process of former owners trying to get their buildings back. And after a year or two, a lot of these buildings that haven't been looked after because it wasn't clear who was sort of in sort of possession of the buildings to look after them, a lot of the buildings have been overgrown by plants, completely green, and nobody was watering them, nobody was fertilizing these plants, nobody was looking after them, and yet they were like a green oasis in the city. And that's, for me, always this example: if we let nature do what it wants to do, it will conquer all places, and that includes building envelopes. And if we do the job well, then we actually just create places to enhance the ability for natural plants to settle.
Nature doesn't always need the human being. It can do what it wants to do.
No, but we can sort of make it easier for plants. You know, this is a bit like sort of pot plants. When we have them in the flat, we water them because there is no natural rain. We fertilize them because there are no leaves and nothing that would sort of re-fertilize the ground naturally. that's what we have to do on buildings too. And in mm-hmm. some cases, we might need to water. In some cases, we might need to drain. But generally, if we go for local plants with a good resistancy in the natural place, in the natural environment, then the success is normally much, much bigger. And that's what we see in Singapore. It's just that it's, you know, so beautiful there with all these natural plants and all the sort of natural blossoms. They just exist happily in this very mild and beautiful climate. So, you know, that makes life a little bit easier. I was joking earlier on saying that in Singapore, you just, you know, don't need to act against the plants and the plants will do their job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, support them. Not yeah. act against them. Yeah. Well, I know that Singapore is your favorite example from both of you, but Arup has offices in over 30 countries worldwide and with more than 15,000 employees. How do the working methods differ from country to country? And how do you manage international and interdisciplinary cooperations? Let's not consider Corona for once.
The way we work is that we try to collect all the knowledge and experience globally and to share it within our skills networks. Our skills networks go across disciplines worldwide. We involve everybody in there and we want to learn from each other what is possible in some places. And then locally, we have to decide what stands a chance to be successful. The idea is that we collect global knowledge and that we deliver locally what is possible, suitable, affordable, and appropriate. Not everything works everywhere, but very often we can learn from approaches from other places, even though they might require then to be locally adjusted.
And you have a quite nice way to communicate with each other. You told us last time that it's usual that you're having video calls and not like only phone calls. So you just like recognize the person you're talking to.
I mean, many years ago, there was a decision in order not to be a big global firm with local subsidiaries that run sort of individually. It was a decision that we need to invest very heavily into the bonding between people so that it works as one big global team. And the decision was made very, very early on. Even when you write an email, you see the picture of the person you write to. And we have been equipped since quite a long time with the option that if we want to speak to each other, that we use the internet and that we use picture phones or video calls. And that gives you the opportunity that you actually get to know people. It's not the same as face-to-face, but it comes closer to face-to-face. And I've experienced people in video calls for many years. And then after several years, I've actually met them face-to-face. And there was sort of the feeling that we know each other quite well because we have been communicating all the time. And you know, you see reactions, you know how people behave, you know gestures and so on. And that creates a degree of familiarity that enables you to work better with each other.
Which is not that easy with 15,000 people. So it's quite a huge family.
It is a huge family, but you would be surprised how well connected people are. It is actually so that we have the feeling that everybody is in connection with everybody. And I would say personally, it's probably 3,000-4,000 people that I've been personally in contact through video conferences, through the skills network meetings and so on. I've never counted, but it's a huge amount of people that you're actually in contact with that when you meet them, you know, you have a degree of familiarity when you sort of start talking to each other, you think, oh, I know you from, and sometimes, you know, we talk about, where was it? Which project did we do together? And we have to sort of sort it out a little bit. But you recognize people by their gestures or their behavior or their looks. And you think, where is this person from? I can't remember which project it was. But it's sometimes quite funny that, you know, people are not static in Arup. They kind of migrate through different disciplines. They sort of develop. We have people who started with MEP and migrated into fire engineering. We have project managers which migrated into architecture. We've got architects who moved into lighting design, or you know, all that sort of thing. Over the last sort of 20 years, people have sort of developed, and sometimes you see somebody in a context that you didn't get to know them in. Sometimes you get to know them in a completely different context, and suddenly you meet them sort of 5 or 10 years later somewhere else, and you think, where do I know them from? I haven't done a lighting project with them. And it turns out that it was sort of an architectural project somewhere else, you know. But that's quite nice. In a way, that's really nice.
Absolutely. And there is a key message from Arup we like a lot, which says that you want to shape a better world. And having a look on your website, one can find like more than 500 publications on future scenarios of cities and countries, but also about digital processes. And last but not least, about the green infrastructures. So it's quite unusual for an office to publish and share its knowledge this broadly. Why is this so important to Arup?
I mean, first of all, we have to say that we are in 100% possession of the foundation. So Over Arup has turned the office into a foundation and has sort of put the operational office in the 100% possession of the foundation to make sure that Arup can carry on the way it sort of developed without external influences. For example, there was the risk that personal partners who were sort of partly owning the firm as well, who had sort of personal shares, would sort of die one day, and their heritage would go to the family, who might not have something to do with the engineering practice. And then it's sort of a natural process that they would try to sell that off. And with that, you have an uncontrolled influence that could come into the firm. And to avoid that, he put the firm into a foundation, and the foundation is run by the members of the firm, and by these means it sort of secured that nobody can actually buy out the firm, nobody can sell shares, and external influences with a particular direction are not possible. So having said that, we are not a profit-driven company, because all the profits go to the foundation, and the foundation in itself is dealing with the money and is operating in shaping a better world. That's the sort of background of it. And most of the money goes to third world water aid projects.
Wonderful.
But with, I mean, that's one of the sort of major focuses, water aid. Having said that, over the last sort of 10 years, the focus has shifted a little bit, because there have been quite a lot of natural disasters in a lot of other areas too. And we, for example, in Germany, we have sort of applied for money from the foundation to support the refugees in Germany from Syria. We've been given money to support the local government in executing refugee homes and so on. These things happen, but the focus is still third world water aid. That could be that we create a bridge over a gorge, where you then have sort of a shorter distance to fresh water. It could be that we help to build a well. Sometimes it's also that we help to improve schools to become earthquake secure buildings. Sometimes we build schools. We can apply for projects, and we collaborate, and it's our young staff who get a chance. They can apply for that, and then they there's a selection process, and then they get sent on site for a period. They will then be involved in the planning process, and then in the execution under very tough conditions, and they choose for that, and then they go there and help to realize the project. And that is something that we feel is very, very good for especially young people, to actually experience what it means, the responsibility that you have as being born in the right part of the world with sort of very good conditions to give something back. And that's sort of the idea behind it. Shaping a better world, however, doesn't stop there. It also sort of, you know, the idea is being brought back into our own environment. Here too, we should make sure that we are not focusing on making profits at any cost, but that we do the right sort of thing with the idea that we leave the world just that little bit better than when we are born into it.
That makes absolutely sense and has a really, really wonderful idea. And what a great concept. Congratulations on that one. Really.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's not my concept, but it's a great concept that we all have to buy into. If we want to work for the firm, that is sort of the basic foundation that we buy into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Plus, when you mentioned the publications, I just would like to elaborate briefly on that. All the publications, we feel that sharing improves the world. And if we want to shape a better world, we cannot just rely and dwell on the knowledge that we work with together. We need to share that also externally, because we collaborate also with people externally. And sharing, it means improving overall. And that makes life for us easier in collaboration with our partners outside the firm. And we want to collaborate with the best people in the world. And they are not only in Arup, they are also outside Arup.
But you have many of them.
Well, we hope so, yeah. And we aim for that.
Especially sharing knowledge brings the world a lot more together and further on. And we would like to talk briefly about one particular publication. Diane and you have already met upon this topic. It's Green Building Envelope. What is that all about?
Well, it's to come back to the Singapore idea. Green Building Envelope was originally sort of generated when a colleague of mine was doing a similar publication, which had the name Towards Green Infrastructure, Cities Alive Towards Green Infrastructure. And there he said, our cities need a lot more plants. The denser they get, the more important the role of the plants. And I was saying, well, if the city gets ever denser, where is the place coming from for all these plants? Mm-hmm. And then we collaborated on sort of elaborating on his idea with Green Building Envelope by saying we can give about 5 times the surface area back that we built on. If you imagine a cube, roughly buildings are cubical. If you imagine a cube, the cube has 6 sides. It's standing on one side and it has 5 times the area that you're standing on exposed to all hemispheres plus the roof. And the idea is that if you give 20% of each of the sides and the roof back, you cover 100% of the plot that you built on. Singapore idea, you actually should give back what you're occupying. And that's the idea of Green Building Envelope. And Green Building Envelope has this purpose of evaporation cooling, so we avoid heat islands. It's also become much more important these days. Therefore, we need to be selective with the plants, but not plants, tropical plants or visual plants. We need to give plants back which have a big leaf surface, because with that, we can filter the fine dust in our denser cities. And at the same time, the substrate on which the plants grow help us to reduce ambient noise in cities. So noise, heat, and cleanliness of air are key in order to be able to do natural ventilation. If you want to open the window in a dense urban city, if you're living in a dense urban city overnight, you want to be able to open the window to benefit from the cooler night air. Natural ventilation reduces CO2 emission because we don't need air condition then. But to do that, the air needs to be clean, the temperature needs to be as low as possible, and you mustn't have a lot of noise. otherwise your sleep is disturbed. So these three key factors, and there are plenty more benefits from plants as they are stress lowering and helping to reduce health issues of people. But as engineers, we feel those three key issues, noise, heat, and cleanliness of the air, are very, very important to enable us to work more with natural ventilation, free cooling, and so on. And almost on all places all over the world, you can do natural ventilation and free cooling for some part of the year. And if you just imagine that you do it for a third of the year only, that means a third less for cooling and heating.
Which wow. in some countries is a mess.
It's lots. I mean, even in places, and I know a lot of people giggle when I say that, but even in places like Dubai or Abu Dhabi and so on, where you have extremely high temperatures during the day, the temperature at night very often drops significantly.
Yeah.
But in the dense urban fabric, it doesn't drop as much because it's upheating so much. Mm-hmm. Have we got more plants on the buildings? It doesn't upheat so much, then we benefit more of the night cooling effect, and then we can do natural ventilation. And funnily enough, all of these buildings there, all the residential buildings, no matter how high they are, normally have balconies to step outside. And, you know, if we want to benefit from that, we need to get temperatures to a level where it is comfortable to sit outside. And that can be achieved with more plants. Now, there is a lot of discussion that in places like that, you need to irrigate the plants. You need to water them. Is that sensible in places like that? Well, the answer to that is, in all these places, we have salt water desalination for normal water usage. The wastewater, however, can be used to water the plants. Mm-hmm. And if we use that, we have sufficient water. Is more than sufficient water to irrigate the plants. And what has also been shown that with the huge parks in Dubai, which they water, the temperature level has dropped. And, you know, the sort of microclimate improves a lot. Mm-hmm. And with the improvement of the microclimate, plants can exist better and you don't need quite as much water. And I'm aware of the fact that we are talking now really long term. It probably takes another 50 years or so before this benefit becomes sort of a benefit that you can feel beyond just being able to measure it. But I think this is a long term effect, and we can discuss whether that is a sort of a good idea to build in the desert a city for millions of people. But we can't discuss whether it's going to happen or not. It has happened. Now that it has happened, I think we need to make the best out of that situation. And there is a high level of improvement possible if we bring more plants into the city. And that's true for all the locations that I can imagine. There is a simple proof if you look from outside space with cameras, with a normal camera, and you detect where it's green. You have the plants, it's greener, and you take the same shot with a camera that measures temperature. And then you see wherever it's greener, it's cooler. And wherever it's cooler, we can save energy. And when we can save energy, we can reduce CO2 emission. It's all about sustainability and improving our living conditions in the long run.
And I mean, Dubai has air-conditioned bus stops, so I don't think they should have a problem working with plants.
No.
And that's actually the issue of Dubai, the streets covering the desert sand, because the sand saves the cool air, and that's why the city is heated up so much.
Yes, I don't even want to dwell on Dubai, even if it wasn't so beneficial in a place like that, even though I think it is, you know. There is huge areas in the world, the sort of most densely populated areas in the world have a high potential to improve their living conditions if we bring more plants into the city.
Absolutely. So we were talking now about these big cities from all over the world, but unfortunately within the last 4 months, We haven't really been able to travel a lot and have a look what the cities look like nowadays. So how did your life change, or how is your everyday life today?
Well, I mean, it's home office as was required. We have to say that we as a company, due to the fact that we have been working over many sort of big distances with our colleagues with video conferencing and what I mentioned before, we have been comparatively well prepared. It was still a big step for us within, let's say, 4 to 6 weeks, having suddenly almost 16,000 people in home office. That was a sort of a major test whether the systems would work. But every one of the 16,000 people has had sufficient experience in working remotely with colleagues. So the situation wasn't entirely new. What was new, whether, you know, it would work with all 16,000 people in home office.
Yeah.
That was new, and that has worked out reasonably well. Therefore, we are actually quite happy. And there is a lot of discussions now whether we all will come back to the office, or whether the future will be having a higher content of home office. But I have to say, I'm not a very big friend of that idea, because working multidisciplinary, involving all disciplines, I feel that we need to be together to learn from each other. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work if you come together only for meetings to report results. And my question always is to people who defend home office to the extent that it's sort of the only good means, I'm asking, where would people learn from? I mean, where would the young people learn from? The way they learn is by seeing how others are doing it. By supporting others in doing things, they learn and sort of acquire processes and so on. That doesn't work in home office as well. It might work to a degree, but not as well. I have to admit that maybe it is sensible to go into a sort of halfway house, that we say, you know, you work 3 days in the office and maybe 2 days not, and something like that. But we need to be careful that we get sufficient overlap, that the process of learning from each other and also cross-fertilizing what structures are doing and MEP are needing and what envelope is doing and what building physics needs as a result, and to deal with the lighting designer and to think about the architectural requirements. All these things, you know, have to come together, and in the end even need to be coordinated with the project managers and so on. All of that comes together in an office so much easier. I'm not saying it can't be developed, but as of now, I feel that face-to-face in an office, exposure of issues can be resolved easier in an office.
Is there something you personally miss the most during the last 4 months?
I mean, what I miss is not meeting people like you, Diane, in Singapore.
I'll miss you too.
No, I think it is a great thing to meet people. And I think face-to-face meetings give a lot more information than only just video conferencing. If you know each other really well, you can sort of fill the gaps.
Yeah.
And it works for a while, but I don't think it works forever. And in Arab, we normally say up to 2 years, we can sort of work with video conferencing, but then it's time for a face-to-face meeting again in the skills network. So every 2 years, we have a forum for the disciplines where all the colleagues come together so that they actually meet and greet each other, that new people are being integrated, creating connections across borders and so on. That's not so easy to be done only by video conference.
Absolutely.
But with Corona, we have since February a whole new situation, and the decision by our global board has been taken that for 1 year until next February, no matter independent of Corona developments, at least until February next year, we will not allow internal travel so that we gather the experience and see what it does to us. So, you know, if the situation allows, I might be able to travel to meet a client. But we don't want what we've done before. If there was like a design meeting and somebody said, wouldn't it be great if you came along to the meeting to London or something like that, somebody would jump in a plane and be in London. We now deliberately decided for a year not to do that, to see whether we get along, whether that works, if it has any effects on us. Just really testing and trying out, because in the long run, not traveling, that's also a lot of CO2 emission that we reduce.
Absolutely.
Shaping a better world doesn't stop with planning a building. It also stops with our behavior.
Yeah, that's right.
And if there's 15,000 people not traveling that much anymore, we will surely realize that.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, we have seen that suddenly satellite photos of Beijing allowed to see the street and the cars again, which wasn't possible for decades. And this is, I mean, just imagine about the strength of nature to sort itself out in 8 or 10 weeks.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's something we would never had achieved by ourselves. It's really just due to this special situation that we were kind of forced to stay at home and just keep calm.
Yeah.
And nobody really believed that nature can relax that quickly. It was a really nice example by nature. And everything you describe, Rudy, also emphasizes your special connection within Arup. And as we also read, Arup is already working on possible solutions like reopening cities worldwide. The world's urban population thrives on the energy of interactions, creativity, passion, and culture that city life provides. COVID-19 challenges almost all of this. Therefore, you have used your analytical thinking and design tools to support finding a path through the pandemic, perhaps reshape our environment or organizations for future resilience. We assume you haven't found all the answers yet, but let's talk about some possible sceneries. What are the principal and then most important changes cities would need to think about, in your opinion?
No, we haven't found all the answers, and I don't think it is possible to find all answers.
Come on.
You know, the Japanese say the path is the aim, or the aim is the path. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to find solutions as we go along, and there is always room for improvement, always. And what we're looking at the moment is, you know, I mean, city resilience is for us a subject since a long time, not just in the pandemic. But what it showed to me, quite frankly, when I heard about city resilience, I was thinking about third world countries, huge agglomerations like Mexico, you know, some of the sort of favelas in Brazil, or, you know, some maybe even refugee camps and stuff like that. I was always thinking that's where resilience is a problem. But I learned very quickly also from our colleagues in conversations that city resilience means a lot more. And really, city resilience can come to us very quickly, which I always kind of thought, wow, it doesn't really come quickly to us. But suddenly with COVID, we have seen how fast we come into such a situation. And we have had situations like that over the last, say, 10, 20 years, more and more. I mean, it started for me with New York when there was 9/11, the attack.
Yeah.
How quickly has New York been turned into a city that didn't have sufficient resilience to operate? Then we have had situations with aggression in Boston. We have seen natural disasters of tsunamis. We have seen situations where power plants failed. We have seen situations where protests, like in Paris on the street, we have seen vandalism that has sort of brought the city into extreme pressured situations where the city almost didn't function. We've seen Hong Kong with the protests just before the pandemic hit us, and then the pandemic which hit us globally. You know, before it was sort of local issues and the rest of the world could kind of watch and try to support. Suddenly we have a global pandemic, and what we felt is that we need to start right where we are, you know, and we are looking how does our office need to change in future to be more set up for situations like that, to be a bit more resilient. And in Japan, they discovered that with the tsunami and all the power failures, that the high-rise buildings, which were completely sealed and only operated on mechanical systems, had a longer period of problems to be back into operation, even even sort of partial operation, was more difficult than those buildings who had built in operable windows, which weren't built for natural ventilation. They were built in case of a fire with smoke exhaust, that you have a natural flow of air, fresh air coming in. But they suddenly could use these openings to get a little bit of cross ventilation, and suddenly these buildings proved to be more resilient. Therefore, they've changed the law that on every floor now they have to have a certain square meterage of operable windows for emergencies. I learned from Joe da Silva, our champion in resilient city design, that first of all, we have learned from trying to repair cities. Now, with that knowledge, what normally needs to be repaired, we should prepare designs for the future that preempt the problems. So we learn from troubled cities how to design cities better so that future cities hopefully will not have the same sort of problem. I'm pretty sure they discover other problems and they will need sort of solving then. But first of all, I think, you know, a lot can be learned from troubled projects for the future, avoiding trouble for even our own cities.
Yeah. And also trying to reduce dependency from the human being to power or energy or what you were talking about.
I mean, there is one rule for me that is always go to the most primitive system that allows you to do what you need to do. Because the most basic and primitive system is what you can fall back to all the time, and you're not dependent on.
And it works.
And it works, and it gives you sort of a better sort of chance to survive. And for me, that's an important rule to do that, because all too often we go the easy way and use energy consumption to cover for what we are too lazy to do manually.
Yeah.
I mean, it starts with a staircase. Why are many buildings designed so that you use lifts and the staircases are hidden away for emergencies? Why are buildings not designed to encourage you to use staircases and the lifts are hidden away for you to use if you really need to? Agreed, for high-rise buildings like the Burj Al Arab, you need lifts because it's, you know, you can't walk 100 floors. But I think even within a building like that, within the sort of range of 5-6 floors, you should be encouraged to use staircases. And I think we need to learn a bit more from the spirit of the place and adopt it a bit more, which, by the way, is also one of the qualities of traveling, that you experience different parts of the world with different conditions. But if the conditions are being all flattened out to be 18 degrees with a suit and tie and shirt, you lose the pleasure of traveling.
That is absolutely crazy. My parents used to live and work in Dubai. And when my father left the house, he actually took his winter sweater to the office because it was so cold there. And that is just actually not imaginable.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a waste of energy. And I think this is, you know, it always comes. And I have to be very careful with judging that, because you know, when I sort of went, for example, to criticize colleagues who worked on a skiing hall in Middle East, they said to me, "What are you criticizing me for? You are heating your swimming pools, your outdoor swimming pools in winter." And I kind of thought, "Oh, yes, maybe
good
we're doing
point.
Similar things." Yeah, you know, I mean, all I'm saying is, you know, it's so easy to look and see what others sort of commit in terms of mistakes, but we need to sort of start with ourselves, and we need to sort of ask ourselves is this the right thing to do? And you know what? There is no problem if we do that. If we can do it with solar-powered heating, which is renewable energy, there's nothing wrong with it. But we need to make the effort to come up with the right system so that we are not a burden to the world.
Absolutely.
And that's what we mean with shaping a better world. Let's not forbid something, but let's find a way that isn't damaging our environment.
So, Rudy, would you have any good advice for our listeners?
Sort of a general advice would for me be go to the most primitive systems, try to avoid CO2 emission, and it can be done.
Very good. Rudy, it was a pleasure spending the time with you, talking to you. Thanks for taking your time.
My pleasure.
We hope that we will be able to meet soon. Maybe in Singapore, maybe anywhere else in the world. But hopefully, we will be able to. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you also from my side. Our listeners will get the chance to see more of Arup's projects online. Soon, we will have an online lecture with you, Rudy, and a special guest from your London's office. We invite you to all the upcoming online lectures and podcasts. Look them up on jung.de/architects.